Representative Barbara Jordan of the House Judiciary Committee addresses the impeachment hearings on President Richard Nixon in 1974.
At this point, I would like to juxtapose a few of the impeachment criteria with some of the actions the president has engaged in. Impeachment criteria, James Madison, from the Virginia Ratification Convention. If the president be connected in any suspicious manner with any person and there be grounds to believe that he will shelter him, he may be impeached. We have heard time and time again that the evidence reflects the payment to defendants, money. The president had knowledge that these funds were being paid, and these were funds collected for the 1972 presidential campaign. We know that the president met with Mr. Henry Peterson 27 times to discuss matters related to Watergate, and immediately thereafter met with the very persons who were implicated in the information Mr. Peterson was receiving. The words are, if the president is connected in any suspicious manner with any person and there be grounds to believe that he will shelter that person, he may be impeached. James Madison again at the Constitutional Convention. A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. The Constitution charges the president with the task of taking care that the laws be faithfully executed. And yet, the president has counseled his aides to commit perjury, willfully disregard the secrecy of grand jury proceedings, conceal surreptitious entry, attempt to compromise a federal judge, while publicly displaying his cooperation with the processes of criminal justice. A president is impeachable if he attempts to subvert the Constitution. If the impeachment provision in the Constitution of the United States will not reach the offenses charged here, then perhaps that 18th century Constitution should be abandoned to a 20th century paper shredder. Has the president committed offenses and planned and directed and acquiesced in a course of conduct which the Constitution will not tolerate? That's the question. We know that. We know the question. We should now forthwith proceed to answer the question. It is reason and not passion which must guide our deliberations, guide our debate, and guide our decision. I yield back the balance of my time, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining this broadcast or listening to Elizabeth Loftus, who's an American cognitive psychologist and expert on human memory. She's best known for her groundbreaking work on false memories.
And then the enemies, you know, they got all up in arms saying, you are recommending that parents lie to their children, you awful person. And I said, give me a break. You know, have you ever heard of Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy? You do it all the time. Yeah. So that tells you a little bit about my foray into wanting to see if you could use memory engineering to help people.
Okay, so how is that different, though, from, say, hypnosis, where a person goes to a hypnotist and says, I would like to stop smoking, or I would like to lose weight, or I would like to whatever I would like to do, and can hypnosis help me do this? The person is going knowing that it's going to be a technique that would be beneficial. Would this I go to a memory doctor to...
I mean, it would be a different way of doing it, and somebody would need to, you know, maybe figure out to do the clinical trial and figure out, do these techniques really work, and which ones lead to longer-lasting benefits, and all the basic research that needs to be done. But this involves making you believe that you had an experience or experiences that you didn't have. Hypnosis doesn't do that. It relaxes you or whatever
right.
it does.
Right.
It plants a suggestion, but it doesn't claim to be planting false memories.
Well, then let's talk then about when you say your critics. Did you say critics or enemies going after you about
why
mothers? Because it really is a very interesting question. If we have the knowledge about manipulating memory for better and for worse, it's a tool like all psychological tools and can indeed be used in ways that are quite Orwellian, right? For example, I was very interested in the recent study that you did with Andrew Morgan with the U.S. military, with naval officers, I guess, in survival training. And this was to see whether you could manipulate their memories of who had interrogated them. Can you tell us a little about this? This is a really interesting study.
Well, this is a big study of these soldiers and other military personnel who are undergoing survival training. They're learning what it's going to be like if they are ever captured as prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. And as part of this grueling and stressful experience, they have a half-hour interrogation that is at times physically aggressive and extremely unpleasant. And later, they have to try to identify the person who conducted that interrogation. But for some of these subjects, they are given a questionnaire and a photo is shown to them. I mean, they're asked a few questions. Did look at this photo of your interrogator. Did he give you anything to eat? Did he give you a blanket? Did he let you talk to other people? This is a different person. And when you do that to these soldiers and sailors and other military personnel, many of them will later identify him as the one who conducted the interrogation. So in a way, you've taken away the memory of the real perpetrator and substituted this other person with this simple manipulation. And we are now trying to publish these findings. I do have a little bit of a reservation about it because it's a recipe for educating people about
how to obliterate a memory.
Well, yeah. Obliterate, yes, how to commit an atrocity and then make your victim unable to prosecute you.
Exactly. So where do you come out on this?
Well, right now we're between rejections. But I feel that it's important to get the information out there and then figure out how to control it or, you know, prevent its misuse or at least be educated so you can defend against the tactics when they're being applied to you.
Well, both sides need to be educated in this respect. I mean, if the police and interrogators want to know a method by which the suspect or victim will not be able to recall correctly what actually happened, this is powerful technique for them to use, and they may not be so inclined to use it fairly, is this true? But it's a great concern, I think. Mm-hmm. But, of course, your work has always been to educate the public and the courts wherever possible about the misuse of memory techniques. And scientific freedom and responsibility seems very crucial here. What other current research are you doing in this or related areas?
Well, my lab is full of terrific graduate students, and we're just, trying to answer some of those questions about these very rich false memories. Who is susceptible and who is more resistant to these kinds of influences, the individual differences question. Are there ways that we can tell the difference between a true memory and a false memory? I recently, with some co-authors, published a neuroimaging study. But are there other behavioral measures? It's not looking very good because the false memories are actually very vivid and real to people. We're interested in whether or not if you are susceptible to a false memory in one classic paradigm, let's say, of false memory research, are you also susceptible in a different one? Is there kind of like a false memory gene or trait? So, I mean, these are ongoing studies, and you'll hopefully be hearing about them.
The neuroimaging, of course, nowadays neuroimaging is all the rage. If we can show where things are in the brain, then we're really doing science and so forth, which is, of course, related to the pursuit of the perfect drug. I myself am waiting for the memory drug. I'm counting on you to provide it before I get too much older, Beth. But let's talk a little bit about the drug question and the efforts to, the efforts to provide a drug that will either block the formation of a traumatic memory or that will improve memories. What do you think?
Well, there have been clinical trials now to involving drugs that you could give to a trauma victim, and it supposedly dampens the memory. So these memory-dampening drugs, they're really interesting, and they raise these unbelievably important questions for society. If people had the opportunity to take one of the drugs, would they want to? And do we have, should we have freedom of our own memory? Or do you have a responsibility to society to keep the memory so that you can go out there and testify and convict the bad guy and, you know, make society a safer place? Just to enter this debate, I and my collaborators have recently are publishing a study on whether people would even want the drugs. And we're to my shock, because, you know, give it to me. I don't want PTSD, and I don't care if my memory's a little damp. But my collaborators, they say, no, I don't want the drug. So we did a study of the public. And to my surprise, the vast majority of people said, no, I don't want the drug. Uh-huh. They want that traumatic memory.
Did you specify what kind of memory we're talking about? After a car accident or after a rape?
First, we tried it, you know, with a mugging and a beating in the park. And then I thought, well, maybe they want to be able to testify and convict the bad guy. Then we tried it with, like, a, you know, your buddy's blown up in Afghanistan, so there's not going to really be a trial. And they still didn't want the drug. Now, this raises a question of whether or not we should force people to take the drug. We force them to get vaccinated.
Why would you force
because
people to have
Because you want to treat all that PTSD and the millions of dollars that the suffering for the person and the millions of dollars it costs for society. Maybe we should encourage or more that people take these drugs to prevent the kind of illnesses that might, that when there's a strong likelihood. It's just a question for us as a society to consider.
Well, but do not people think that their traumatic, unhappy memories are as much a part of their lives and history and who they are as their good memories?
Well, that's why people are telling us they don't want the drug, yes.
Okay. Well, you have had, God knows, unfortunately, some traumatic memories of your own. Would you want not to remember them? Would you want them gone from your mind?
Well, I guess I wouldn't mind being able to think about my mother's death with a little less emotion attached to it. I mean, I don't want to forget her altogether, but I wouldn't mind a little less emotion.
And why?
Because it's painful. I would prefer to be happy.
All the time?
Well, most of the time.
Well, but that's the heart and soul of this. I mean, of course, what psychotherapists, so many psychotherapists do is help people who deal with pain that they cannot get over. And, I mean, what many people do, of course, is self-medicate in all kinds of ways. But it really goes to the heart of who we are, how we want to live. Do we want to obliterate pain, or do we want to learn to live with it, or do we want to get past it in personal ways rather than cutting it out of our minds? No, it's a really, you're right, it's a very important philosophic as well as psychological question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that people want to keep those memories is very touching to me, really. Okay. Well, in the sense of where you think memory research will go and its ability to help people or harm them, William Salatin, in his series in Slate, was very concerned about memory doctors and the future of memory doctoring. He said the memory doctors who were the psychotherapists of the 90s thought they were doing good by helping people uncover their repressed memories of traumatic abuse over all those years. They thought they were doing absolutely the best and most healthy thing. He said the danger, for psychologists who think they're doing good is that very often it backfires in ways that we'd not anticipated. I know you're aware of the criticism that he wrote you the most beautiful profile of your work in Slate. It was absolutely spectacular series. But then he ended with really this question of the potential for real harm if memory tools, if our understanding of memory, I hate to say it quite this way, gets in the wrong hands, but of course any tool can get in the wrong hands. And so do you foresee that your future work for scientific freedom and responsibility might take a different direction in preserving our liberties?
Well, you know, it's a tough choice. I mean, for me, when the critics said, I can't believe you're suggesting that parents lie to their children and make them believe, you know, they got sick eating chocolate ice cream as a kid to move them away. I say, would you rather, you know, have a obese child, you know, suffering all those health consequences and a higher probability of diabetes, and or a little teeny bit of false memory I really see that as a kind of very helpful bit of, you could call it memory engineering or memory restructuring or memory doctoring, whatever you want to call it. it is true. You could imagine this getting in the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, corporations figuring out ways to plant memories of people getting sick on their competitors' products or or whatever. It could be misused. But anyhow, I'm going to leave that to somebody else to figure out. I'll just do the scientific part.
So since I ended my introduction with the AAAS Award for Freedom and Responsibility, I would love it if you would, in our final comments here, talk some about your reflections about your work and career and the legal work that you've done with so many people who have indeed been the beneficiaries of your research.
Well, yeah, that award is very special, and it has brought out, especially with a little bit of publicity given to it, it's brought out these communications from these falsely accused people, and these are the things that, you know, so they write letters of complaint to my bosses, and they try to get me fired, and they threaten my life, and they sue me, whatever. But what reminds me of why I'm doing this work are the kinds of letters I've been getting from these accused people who've lost their families or other major losses in their life, who feel that my work has given them some hope. And they're writing with such pride about that award. So I save those in my When Blue file.
When Blue file.
Yeah, When Blue.
Well, your When Blue file must be pretty huge. Pretty huge, wouldn't you say? Beth, thank you so much for this great conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Just appreciate it.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Say, can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations, where our children can play in a world without war? Where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say, do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on Earth.
In this short excerpt from the movie Gandhi, Mr. and Mrs. Gandhi address the people of India.
But now something worse is happening. When Gandhiji and I were growing up, women wove their own cloth. But now there are millions who have no work because those who can buy all they need from England. I say with Gandhiji, there is no beauty in the finest cloth if it makes hunger and unhappiness.
My message to you is the message I have given to your brothers everywhere. To gain independence, we must prove worthy of it. There must be Hindu-Muslim unity always. Second, no Indian must be treated as the English treat us.
We must remove untouchability from our hearts and from our lives. Third, we must defy the British. not with violence that will inflame their will, but with a firmness that will open their eyes. English factories make the cloth. That makes our poverty. All those who wish to make the English see, bring me the cloth from Manchester and Leeds that you wear today, and we will light a fire that will be seen in Delhi and in London. And if, like me, you are left with only one piece of homespun, wear it with dignity.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where Harlem sits? Put them on the Ritz. Spangled guns upon the bevy of high grounds from down the levee, all this fits. Put them on the Ritz. That's where each and every Lulu Belle goes. Every Thursday evening in her swell clothes.
Come and elbows, come with me.
We'll attend the Jubilee and see the fit their last two bits. Put them on the Ritz.
Short, sharp shock. They don't do it, do they? Dig it. I mean, you got offline because I couldn't get. Now for something completely different.